Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. We have a special edition of our program today. For those of you who would normally expect the latest in health and healing, well, just a few moments ago, I pre-recorded today's health and nutrition segment, and you can go to prn.live, scroll down to the Podbean player, hit play, and you'll get today's health and healing segment. And by the way, you can get this all the time. We have dozens upon dozens upon dozens of segments just on health and healing, so you'll miss nothing. However, for everyone else, I have a special today. I'm going to begin a four-part series. Part one will be today on examining our vaccines, all vaccines, historically right up till now, safe and effective. It is my opinion that virtually everyone in the field, and I mean from Robert Kennedy Jr., who talks about how he's pro-vaccine, all of his children have had all their vaccines, Dr. Malone, he got the COVID vaccine, he and his wife, both vaccines, or two shots, Dr. McCullough, Dr. Cole, every single person you hear will say the first thing out is, now, I'm pro-vaccine, however, on this particular vaccine, there are some issues. Fine. But I believe they've all missed it. I believe we have made one huge mistake in our public health policy. We're assuming that all previous vaccines are safe and effective. So my challenge is simple. Prove it. Now, I have spent over 30,000 hours reviewing the scientific literature on vaccines, interviewing hundreds of clinicians, and thousands upon thousands of scientific peer-reviewed papers. And I'm asking a simple question. What proof does Anthony Fauci, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, the American Pediatric Association, what proof do you have that a child needs a hepatitis B vaccine? What proof do you have that the measles vaccine is what stop measles? During this series, all of which is fully documented, fully footnoted, with real scholarship, there's no political or ideological biasness at all. You'll see the story. And my hope is that you will find this so important that we have one of the largest scandals in American history in science and medicine. Highly educated, very intelligent, and very sincere people have made one glaring error. They've taken it for granted that something is so because someone told them it is so. They did not do their homework. We have. We've done the only homework on this at this comprehensive level that I can see. And I'll just give you an example of this. Who said the following with absolute certainty, and this was repeated ad nauseum by the mainstream media? Today, the word is, quote, nobody said you couldn't get COVID if you're vaccinated. Yes, you did say that you would be protected. Now you're saying we didn't guarantee you were going to be protected. They lied. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, quote, verbatim, when people are vaccinated, they're not going to get infected. Lie. President of the United States, quote, you're not going to get COVID if you have these vaccines. Not true. Rochelle Walensky, CDC director, quote, vaccinated people do not carry the virus and don't get sick. Rachel Maddow, chief propagandist for the mainstream media, in my opinion, quote, now we know the vaccines work well enough that the virus stops. And she went on to elucidate that if you get the vaccine, then you're not going to be infected and you're not going to spread it to other people. Not true. Bill Gates, quote, everyone who takes the vaccine is reducing their transmission. Not true. Albert Bourla, Pfizer CEO, quote, there is no variant that escapes the protection of our vaccines. Just the opposite. Dozens of variants. you're all inaccurate. And yet these are just some of the policymakers who have not been questioned, nor have they been challenged on having been wrong on what was the largest fraudulent fiasco in American health history. And then think of how it adversely affected children. Today, the headlines in the newspaper, children are failing fourth degree math, eighth grade English and arithmetic. We're creating children who are not functional and aware of the importance of reading, writing, and arithmetic, in part because of the stay-at-home orders. And that was from people who said that everyone was equally susceptible to the consequences being affected. All of that is completely wrong. But that's the end of the story at this moment. What we do not know, but what we're finding out every single week, are new studies, independent studies coming out, showing that higher rates of other illnesses attributed to the vaccines, including in children, AFib. That's coming out now. Brand new article on this. In fact, this just broke today from Dr. Peter McCullough. Quote, atrial fibrillation after COVID vaccine. Troublesome arrhythmia threatens young persons. Quote, last year I was called by a mother from Chicago about her 25-year-old son who had developed atrial fibrillation a few weeks after being forced into taking COVID-19 vaccine by his employer. He was well down the familiar treatment road of drugs to control the rate, beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, blood thinners to reduce the chances of stroke from a blood clot in the heart, and procedures including it's a shock of the heart, meaning they stop the heart. They literally cause the heart to stop with these defibrillator paddles, and it's called electrical cardioversion. What they don't tell you, however, is that it can come right back again, and also internal catheter ablation, which again is burning out part of the heart muscle, which may temporarily stop it. It did with a friend of mine who got it, but then it came back again, and they never explained that to you. Quote, like so many, her question was, could the vaccine have caused the problem? While atrial fibrillation is the most common heart rhythm, it has a distinct association with older age and is unusual in age 25. Other risk factors include obesity, alcohol intake, hypertension, and forms of myocarditis and valve disease. For this young man, none of these applied. We concluded that he was one of a legion of Americans who are, quote, vaccine injured, now incurring hospitalization, clinical appointments, and rising healthcare costs due to COVID vaccines. And a recent Zogby survey found that 15% of Americans have some new disease or medical problem from the vaccine, and like this young man, regret ever having walked into the vaccine center for the unnecessary shot. He had already had COVID-19 in the past, which was like a mild head cold. And Coomer et al. Have recently reported atrial fibrillation from the safety database after COVID vaccination. And it continues, because that can cause you death. So imagine a young person who had no health problems, ideal health, forced to take the vaccine, and now has got a life-threatening condition that his insurance is not going to cover in all likelihood. And the insurance companies that are insuring the government and the private corporations, everyone is saying, we're not covering any of this. You can't sue any of the manufacturers or the promoters of the vaccines. And now we're seeing the truth. But we've had the truth for a long time, and we chose not to see it. We chose to go right by it. So today I'm starting a 5-part series with all the footnotes to show you what everyone missed. Because had we been honest in the past, had we done proper clinical trials with one group receiving a saline solution and another group receiving the vaccine, because the game they play is they give you, the placebo group will get a vaccine that the manufacturers already know is going to have a higher association of side effects. And then they compare it to their vaccine. And if there's any statistical significant lessening of adverse effects with the vaccine group than the placebo group, even though the placebo was a vaccine, then they herald that as, you know, a major breakthrough. It's all fraudulent because they haven't taken, for example, 10,000 children, cross-matched them for age and health, and then give one group a saline solution, salt solution, water solution, and then the other, the vaccine, then measure them every 6 months for 5 years. That would be a proper scientific study. That study has never been done. And so I'm going to report now on, are vaccines really safe and effective? During the final weeks of 2020, hundreds of millions of people worldwide eagerly awaited the opportunity to be vaccinated against the SARS-2 virus. They were given assurance that these vaccines were highly effective for preventing infection and were perfectly safe. Since the new and novel RNA vaccines are built upon a completely new genetic-based technological platform than older conventional vaccines, they were easily sold to the public as uniquely innovative and more safe. Moreover, we were told that there was a 95% effectiveness. They would also prevent transmission, so we were told, and this would ultimately bring to an end the pandemic. Life would return to normal. Across the medical establishment and the media airwaves, these new vaccines heralded a miracle of medical science in record-setting time. It didn't require much time after the vaccine's rollout that signs appeared that their promises were at best wishful thinking. Now, let's just jump right up to a week ago. In October 2022, Pfizer's chief executive for developing markets testified before a European Parliament Special Committee on COVID and admitted the vaccine had never, I repeat, never been tested for the prevention of viral transmission. This was shock to many and directly contradicted everything we were told by everyone in the pro-vaccine arena. Doctors, pharmacists, nurses, public health officials, Bill Gates, Anthony Fauci, and virtually everyone, especially the cheerleader for the vaccines, Rachel Maddow, on MSNBC. Furthermore, reports of serious and life-threatening vaccine-induced injuries and deaths increased exponentially. So what have we learned in the last 2 years from the actual science? Well, almost 2 years after Pfizer and Moderna's RNA therapies were launched, tens of thousands of physicians and clinicians, professors at prestigious medical schools, and researchers worldwide are stepping forward to demand an immediate halt to COVID-19 vaccination, particularly for young adults and children. Several national health ministries, including Denmark and Sweden, have stopped vaccinating adolescents and children altogether. In Israel, health authorities are voicing their concerns. Opinions in the Israeli National News reported that Pfizer had used the nation as a staging group for rolling out COVID-19 vaccine, by the way, the first country to have done so. In effect, and without consent, former Israeli President Netanyahu recruited up to 7 million citizens to unwittingly participate in a grand experiment. Israeli citizens were deprived of sufficient information about Pfizer's vaccine to make a personal risk-benefit assessment. Quote, what they, meaning Israeli citizens, are being asked to inject is not a vaccine defined by the CDC as a product that stimulates a person's immune system to produce immunity to a specific disease, end quote, writes Jerusalem Health Wellness Counselor Ilana Rachel Daniel. In an op-ed, quote, rather it is an experiment and a novel technology. It is, in fact, a medical device, a physical device that comes in a molecular-sized package, end quote. Today, Pfizer, Moderna, and Anthony Fauci at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease have walked back, reversed themselves on many of their earlier claims about the benefits of COVID vaccines. They made it abundantly clear that these vaccines are not intended to stop transmission, but only to prevent serious illness and death. But even that is highly questionable after taking into account the high rates of SARS-2 infections among vaccinated. In the United States, as of the first week of August 2020, the U.S. and European Union's Vaccine Injury Reporting System, their figures, not mine, cumulatively record, please listen carefully, everyone, and put this in perspective. In 1976, when the swine flu vaccine was given to 40 million Americans, we had 23 known deaths. They immediately yanked it from the market. That's 23. Currently, their most recent figures, 76,880 deaths, 6.1 million injuries serious enough to require special medical assistance or hospitalization. The United States, 29,800 deaths and 1.4 million injuries. And those are only those voluntarily recorded in the CDC's Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. The VAERS data is available for public access. However, the system does not include adverse events reported in the separate data link reporting system, a privately controlled database that is regarded as more thorough. Also, according to a Harvard study, up to 1% of adverse events, including deaths, are reported, which means 99% are not. Now, why don't we add 99% more deaths onto what we're showing in America, and we no longer have 29,800 deaths, then you have hundreds of thousands of deaths and well over 10 million injuries, and many of those life-threatening or permanent. Not a single editorial could I find in any health column, in any major news media, or any of the dozens of panelists who appear regularly on behalf of special interest groups, always without telling us their background and what conflict of interest they have, both financial or ideological, to promote a particular agenda. We don't have truly independent experts discussing an issue, and none of them have told us how bad it is. So what does it say when we would ban a vaccine when 23 die, but we won't ban a vaccine? We praise the vaccine, and we insist even more people get the vaccine when clearly more than 200,000 minimally Americans have died and 29,800 by their official death count, which we know could be up to 99% missing numbers. For decades before the advent of the novel RNA gene therapy injections, the mainstream medical and scientific communities have promulgated an unassailable decree that vaccines are, without exception, both safe and effective, whether administered individually or in any combination. For more cautious medical professionals, there remains an unchallenged belief that vaccines are effective, but not always safe. Vaccine-injured children and adults are simply regarded as exceptionally rare cases who unpredictably suffered unfortunate consequences. Even many parents with two children develop neurological complications after vaccine will continue to follow the recommendation in the vaccine schedule with unwavering blind faith in their physicians and the nation's medical authorities, and go ahead after the first two children who were vaccinated end up with autism or some form of physical disability and vaccinate the third. Any medical physicians, scientists, nurses, public health advocates, politicians, or journalists who question any aspect of the myth of vaccine safety and efficacy is often immediately attacked, ridiculed, and denigrated as a conspirator. The pro-vaccine propaganda machine recruits articulate doctors and university professors who often sit on federal vaccine oversight boards and committees to engage in ad hominem personal attacks against vaccine dissenters. Today, the situation is different. During the COVID pandemic, the number of medical professionals speaking out against the COVID vaccines, as well as the adenovirus vector vaccines developed by AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson, have grown exponentially. No longer are those who question vaccine safety and efficacy lone individual voices. Today, medical doctors are organizing themselves. Before the pandemic, it would have been unheard of in all of American history for physicians and professors from prestigious medical schools to organize and convene conferences and seminars to present their scientific findings and research and clinical experience to directly discredit the official pandemic and vaccine narratives. It never happened before in American history. The question before us is, if the captains and generals of our national health system, their medical advisors and pharmaceutical executives who approve and advocate for compulsory vaccination could get the evaluation of the COVID vaccines so wrong, and remember, I quoted them verbatim, and they continued to be wrong about everything. They were wrong about the mask. You don't need masks. Then you do need masks. Then you need two masks. Then you need three. They were wrong. We presented at the only one I'm aware of in the United States, the actual clinical data on the safety of masks and where masks, N95 masks, can certainly prevent certain particulate matter if a person sneezes or coughs at a large quantity from getting in through the masks. We do not have a mask small enough in its filtration to allow oxygen in so a person can breathe without suffocating, or to allow the carbon dioxide and any viral bacterial particles to be expressed out of the mask, so you're not rebreathing in toxic air. We had two examples. These were independent of one another. They both involved young people, teenagers. In one, we had a common mask, and then we used every single type of mask, from cloth mask and bandana mask, clear up to the N95 masks. And in both cases, an alarm inside both masks when the oxygen level dropped down into around 19 when it should be around 21, an alarm went off, lack of oxygen to the brain. And within 16 seconds, every single mask went on to alarm. Then the same test, the same masks, different group of high school students, and every single one tested the same. Carbon dioxide buildup, which is toxic, and it, within 16 seconds of every student wearing any kind of mask, the alarm went off. That should have been front page headlines that the safety and efficacy of the masks are being legitimately challenged, and not to say that they weren't capable of breathing in something, but rather this toxic, but rather what other science do we have to support the safety of contraction of a virus versus the consequences of the treatment, the mask being more dangerous frequently than the virus, especially for younger people. But that discussion never happened because we're not allowed to have discussions. We're not allowed to have debates. We're not allowed to have anything that challenged it. In fact, it is so bad that even today, the governor of California has signed or is signing a piece of legislation as of January 1st. If you challenge any aspect of the COVID program in your medical doctor, you'll lose your license and be fined. So that's how draconian it has become. So shouldn't we be asking, if all these people were wrong constantly about everything, they were wrong about the PCR test being an accurate indicator that you're infected, they were wrong. They were wrong about the number of people actually dying from COVID, which was about in the neighborhood of 9%, more or less, that's according to the federal agency itself, versus comorbidities that were the actual cause of death, where the person merely had a COVID infection along with end-stage cancer, end-stage emphysema, the real cause of death. If that were the case, then they missed this altogether, inflating death rates, inflating infection rates, and then over-inflating the enthusiasm of the false science that the vaccines were safe and effective when they were neither. And they were wrong about everything. So why should you continue to believe these people or the television programs, whether it's CNN or MSNBC or the New York Times? Why would you, being lied to repeatedly on not just this issue, but so many other issues, weapons of mass destruction, which are the Judith Miller, the New York Times, promoted this. That was one of the most important elements to get the liberal community, which embraced the war in Iraq with full authority. Look at Hillary Clinton and all, and Barack Obama. Look at all the people who are good quality Democrats who said war, war, war. It's much like the Marx Brothers and Duck Soup, the movie they made about praising war. And now those same people are praising other wars, and no question on let's arm to the hilt. Where are the peace activists within our legislation? Oh, they don't exist. And good science in the question of vaccines does not exist. And yet, how then are they the problem when we have seen how they lie, distort information, falsify issues? At what point do we have to stop and say, what role does my complicity in this count for allowing this myth to go forward in groupthink? So that's the question. If they've been wrong all along with deadly consequences, then why would you still accept their advice today, especially when no one in the media has challenged everything they've been wrong about or the deaths? And how much do we know about the shadow lobbying foundations and think tanks who have been wrong constantly, the publications and their institutions that have been wrong, like the Lancet, the American Journal of, or the American Medical Association Journal? They've been wrong. What if vaccines have never been satisfactorily confirmed to be safe and effective by independent quality science, which they have not? Did the CDC and vaccine manufacturers always know about vaccines' shortcomings, yet intentionally ignore them? That is what the Freedom of Information Act documents are proving. After several decades of studying the scientific literature regarding vaccines, follow the money. And interviewing many dozens of toxicologists, immunologists, research physicians, pediatricians, and medical journalists, the vaccine paradigm can now be accurately deconstructed with reliable, independent science. What was one of the biggest motivating reasons to be vaccinated? Because you had developed herd immunity. Remember that? At the start of the COVID vaccine fallout or rollout, Americans were given assurances by the medical authorities that massive vaccination compliance was crucial to reach herd immunity. We were told that vaccination was absolutely necessary to protect us from the unvaccinated, that we had a pandemic of the unvaccinated, those who are likely to cause their loved ones, especially elderly, to die because they become infected, were the unvaccinated. It was actually just the opposite. It was citizens' patriotic and moral duty to get vaccinated in order to protect the most vulnerable and the immune deficient from serious SARS-2 infections. If enough of the population gets vaccinated, we were told we would reach herd immunity and bring an end to the pandemic. But is there any strong, actual, independent, clinical peer review evidence to give credibility to this viewpoint? A foundational truth across all scientific research is replication of laboratory experiments and clinical trials, with the result being the same as the original findings, no matter who carries out the experiment. If scientist A finds that a vaccine has been effective, then can scientist B, unaffiliated with scientist A, take the same protocols and come up with the same results? If not, then there is a flaw in the original science. On a monthly basis, even with very high vaccine rates, the target for reaching hypothetical herd immunity continues to change. Even with compliance increases, vaccine-induced immunity and efficacy wanes. Hence, there is a constant need to administer, you guessed it, even more boosters and more frequently. For example, the influenza vaccine is known to be useless for conferring long-term immunity. Annually, flu vaccines must be specifically formulated. Developing seasonal flu shots is based upon hypothetical calculations to predict which strains might appear that year. In the past, these predictions have been seriously flawed and often failed to lessen infection rates, but had side effects for the older or younger who took the vaccines. Dr. Fauci was confronted with the question of why the vaccination herd immunity threshold for SARS-2 was changing. Fauci was unable to provide a scientifically sound reply because there is none. What Fauci and other advocates of the vaccine herd immunity theory categorically ignore is the role of natural immunity within the population. They also leave out the unknown percent of people who already have very robust immune systems, live a healthy lifestyle, and do not have any medical conditions that might seriously compromise their health if they were to catch an infectious illness. Healthy individuals may certainly contract an infectious virus or bacteria. However, they are far more likely to be asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic and will benefit by strengthening natural immunity. There is now many studies providing evidence that unvaccinated individuals who have been infected by SARS-2 have longer lasting immunity than that provided by the vaccines. In the propagation of herd immunity, neither of the above populations were considered to ascertain a more effective and vigorous preventative strategy to reduce the severity of a successful treatment of SARS-2 infections. To the contrary, those advocating for the importance of natural immunity, meaning, okay, you're infected. Now your immune system is going to be strong. Your body will remember the memory immune cells. So if you come in contact with the skin, you can still get infected again, but it's almost always milder. But those people were ridiculed and silenced. The question is, why is there such disdain towards anyone who questions the official narrative, even with facts warning discussion? One problem is that the edifice upon which our modern vaccination regime is built relies upon the hypothesis of herd immunity. Absent a belief in the plausibility of herd immunity, there is no sound basis to enforce vaccination mandates. Modern herd immunity theory is largely a dishonest marketing stunt. It follows the old adage of garbage in, garbage out. In order for a vaccine to be truly effective, it must be able to prove that vaccinated persons are unable to transmit a pathogen. A fully vaccinated person may still harbor pathogens, may be asymptomatic, and still infect others. For many years, scientists who espouse the vaccine herd immunity argument have claimed that approximately 95% of the population must be vaccinated in order to protect the smaller percentage who are not immunized. By following such a stratagem, infectious diseases will eventually be eradicated. But for this theory to have any viability, vaccines must be perfectly effective and provide long-term immunity. None are. Nor should vaccines-induced immunity have a termination date. Yet no vaccine has been proven with any certainty to confer lifelong immunity. As we have observed during the start of the COVID vaccination campaigns, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease 95 compliance target was a purely fabricated number. There's no science behind it. Other percentages touted were as low as 70%. This is a fundamental problem for calculating herd immunity thresholds for the vaccines. Such thresholds are based upon algorithmic computer modeling, which never accurately imitates real-life scenarios. The Israeli authors of the recent book, Turtles All the Way Down, Vaccine Science and Myth, a voluminous and heavily cited critique of the CDC's childhood vaccine schedule, notes that the discrepancy in calculations to determine herd immunity thresholds can diverge by as much as 40%. This is the case for measles and diphtheria shots. For rubella, there's a 30% discrepancy range. These degrees of inaccuracy alone raise serious doubts about the biological legitimacy of herd immunity. Periodic and localized measles outbreaks have frequently fueled vaccine hysteria. We can take the measles, mumps, rubella, the MMR vaccine, as an example that shatters the credibility of the herd immunity. For the measles vaccine, according to the CDC study, the population at any given time may have less than 70% immunity. This is despite the fact that one at one time, the MMR vaccine compliance in the United States reached 98%. One of the most opportunistic incidences of a measles outbreak took place in Boston at Boston University a month after a campus blood drive. As a result, health officials had access to a large selection of students' blood samples, both infected and measles-free. Laboratory analysts found that 8 out of 9 students who contracted measles were fully vaccinated. China offers another example, which is believed to have the highest vaccine compliance rate in the world. The measles vaccine is mandatory on the Chinese mainland. So why were there over 700 measles outbreaks in a 3-year period between 2009 and 2012 when 99% of the Chinese were vaccinated for measles? Clearly, the vaccine is incapable of reaching this fictional herd immunity. Another medical discovery that debunks the MMR herd immunity theory is that live virus vaccines shed. This means that a vaccine's viral component can be transmitted and infect persons that a vaccinated person comes into contact with. Perhaps the best documented case occurred in New York City in 2011 when an adult woman received 2 MMR shots and subsequently infected 4 others in her workplace. 2 of those infected were also immunized with 2 of the MMR doses. All cases involved in the incident were confirmed by laboratory testing, and government health officials concluded that the outbreak was due to, quote, a failure in the MMR vaccine. In other words, the vaccine infected others. The vaccine did. It may also be noted that it is not uncommon in outpatient cancer clinics to provide instructions for persons who are severely immunocompromised to avoid contact with persons who have been recently vaccinated. This is especially true for live viral vaccines. If a vaccinated person can infect others, then this would present a working hypothesis and rationale to argue against vaccinating mandates. Vaccine fear porn promotes the idea that an unvaccinated child poses a danger to everyone he or she comes in contact with, especially other children and the elderly who are immunocompromised with serious illnesses such as cancer or an autoimmune disease. Yet this is an untruth. Attorney Kevin Berry calls this propaganda strategy effective brainwashing. The facts are quite the opposite with respect to the MMR vaccine and other live virus vaccines. It is the vaccinated, I repeat, it is the vaccinated person who equally poses a threat to immunocompromised individuals. The rollout of COVID-19 vaccines has taught us another lesson. During the less than 2 years since their emergency use authorization, we have witnessed a rapid emergence of new SARS-2 coronavirus strains. There's also growing evidence that these fully vaccinated may be more susceptible for being infected by new strains they were not vaccinated against. The reason behind this is inconclusive. Some medical experts and physicians are posing the question as to whether vaccination might be contributing to the emergence of these new polymorphic variants. There are examples of new vaccine-related variants likely associated with over-vaccination. Outbreaks of whooping cough have risen. State and local health authorities investigating and gathering statistics on pertussis outbreaks discovered the highest numbers of infected persons among the vaccinated. For example, Mississippi, with the highest vaccine rate in the country, had a significant increase in whooping cough cases, with 91% of those infected being fully vaccinated. Across the nation, the most highly infected are those who have received 3 or more pertussis shots and boosters. Australian researchers at the government's National Center for Immunization and Research of Vaccine-Preventable Diseases found that the pertussis vaccine effectiveness was waning far more rapidly than expected, even among vaccinated 3-year-olds. Moreover, in 2014, a study confirmed that individuals vaccinated against pertussis can be infectious carriers of the Bordetella bacterium and can likely infect others with who either do not respond immunologically to the vaccine or who are unvaccinated. A conclusion is that pertussis-vaccinated individuals may now be endangering the health of unvaccinated and vaccinated alike. While health officials launched a media campaign to blame unvaccinated individuals for upsurges in pertussis outbreaks, the CDC publicly announced to the contrary. Dr. Anne Schuchat from the CDC stated, quote, "We know there are places around the country where there are large numbers of people who aren't vaccinated. However, we don't think these exemptions are driving this current wave. We think it's a bad thing that people aren't getting vaccinated or exempting, but we cannot blame this wave on that phenomena," end quote. Did that appear anywhere in the media? No. The current DPT vaccines do not protect, again, against the new and more violent strains of pertussis. The first identification of a new violent strain was made in Australia. Shortly thereafter, outbreaks appeared in Southern California. Subsequently, Australian immunologists suggested that the emergence of a new vaccine-resistant B pertussis variant may be due to the over-vaccination, similar to what the world has witnessed with antibiotic-resistant organisms due to the overuse and abuse of antibiotic medications. This might also be occurring with viruses targeted by vaccines. If new pathogenic strains are arising due to over-vaccination campaigns, this destroys the possibility of reaching herd immunity through vaccination. Finally, aside from these contradictory findings that discredit herd immunity, infectious disease outbreaks are financial boons for drug makers. Following the Disneyland measles outbreak, Bloomberg Business responded that Merck's quarterly MMR sales of its vaccines increased by 24%, proving that fear-mongering is a highly profitable enterprise. This concludes part one of a four-part series on Are Vaccines Truly Safe and Effective? Now we're going to go to a clip. And this clip is from Noam Chomsky. It's clip number three, and it tells you about the corruption of every president from Dwight Eisenhower to the current president. And everything he's saying is merely the tip of the iceberg. Why is this clip important? Why should we hear this? Because of the following. We continue to put people in positions of power, assuming that they are honest, that they seek peace, they seek reconciliation, they seek to do what is in the best interest of the full population, not just a particular group, and they've all betrayed us. But before we go there, every day this week I'm going to give you one of the most courageous activist politicians in the world. She is a part of the Irish government in its parliament, but then she was selected to be a part of the European Union Parliament. This is what she's saying to the European Parliament. And remember, the European Parliament, you can be elected for that position, but you have no power. The power comes from unelected officials who head it. And they have hegemonic relationships with the World Economic Forum, etc. Would it be a difference if we had many members of our Congress, left and right, who had the courage to stand up and call it like it is? Now we're going to hear a short minute clip, it's even less than that, from Claire Daly, D-A-L-Y.
War in Ukraine is quickly escalating into a wider horror. And from what I can see, practically nobody in this chamber is doing anything to prevent it. In fact, most people seem to get off on the fact that it's escalating. And at this precise moment, of course, as usual, the voices challenging the rush to war are attacked and silenced, smeared as traitors, cronies, Putin puppets, Kremlin stooges, Russian agents. Frankly, it's pathetic. And I don't make the comparison lightly, but the crudeness and cynicism of these slurs coming from mainstream EU parties might as well have been written by Hermann Göring, who infamously said that even though people never want war, they can be brought to war with threats and smears. He said, all you have to do, tell them they're being attacked, denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing their country to danger. It works the same every way. Where he led, you are following. This House should be ashamed of this debate. Words are being twisted, meaning subverted, and the truth turned on its head. Opposing the horrible madness of war is not anti-European. It's not anti-Ukrainian. It's not pro-Russian. It's common sense. The working class of Europe have nothing to gain from this war and everything to lose. And I find it laughable that those calling for arms to Ukraine never called for arms for the people of Palestine or for the people of Yemen. Unlike you, I oppose all war. I want it stopped. I make no apology for that, and I'm not going to be scapegoated and labelled for it either.
Every day this week, we will bring you a different clip from Claire Daly. We have no such people in our Congress. Look at all the people who voted Democrat and Republican for every dollar that the Pentagon wanted and all the money, the billions, tens of billions of dollars going to Ukraine when they haven't spent a nickel on de-ghettoizing America and bringing factories and work back to America. And yet your so-called liberal community, that's a joke, and your conservative community, and that's a bigger joke, have done nothing, and yet you continue to support them. Well, look at the consequences. But let's take Noam Chomsky to give you an example. If the most powerful person in the world that you elect is so corrupt and the media supports that corruption, at least the media that is politically and ideologically aligned with him and will refuse to show you any of the problems of that corrupt person, then what hope do you have based upon our current political system? Noam Chomsky, The Crimes of U.S. Presidents.
You said that if the Nuremberg principles were applied, every post-World War II president would be indictable.
It's probably true.
Can we run down them real fast? What did Eisenhower do that you would indict him for?
Eisenhower overthrew the conservative nationalist government of Iran with a military coup. He overthrew the first and last democratic government in Guatemala by a military coup and invasion, leading to years of, in Iran, it led to 25 years of brutal dictatorship, finally overthrown in 79. In Guatemala, it led to massive atrocities, which are still continuing. That's after almost 50 years. In Indonesia, this wasn't known until recently, but he conducted the major clandestine terror operation of the post-war period up until Cuba and Nicaragua in an effort to break up Indonesia, strip off the outer islands where most of the resources are, and undermine the what was then considered as a threat of Indonesian democracy. Indonesia was too free and open. It was allowing a political party of the poor to participate. They were gaining a lot of ground, so that Eisenhower supported and helped instigate a military rebellion in the outer islands. This is just for starters. These are all indictable offenses.
What about Kennedy?
Kennedy was one of the worst. Kennedy, first of all, invaded South Vietnam. During the Eisenhower administration, they had blocked a political settlement in 1954 and instituted a kind of a Latin American-style terror state, which had killed maybe 60 or 70,000 people by the end of the Eisenhower period and had instigated a response, a reaction. Kennedy recognized that it couldn't be controlled internally, so he simply invaded. In 1962, about a third of the bombing missions that were carried out by the U.S. Air Force in U.S. planes with South Vietnamese insignia, but U.S. pilot. He authorized napalm. He began the use of chemical weapons to destroy food crops. They began programs which drove millions of people into what amounted to concentration camps. Now, that's aggression. In the case of Cuba, it was just a massive campaign of international terrorism, which almost led to the destruction of the world, led to the missile crisis. And we can continue. Again, these are all indictable offenses.
About Johnson?
Well, Johnson expanded the war in Indochina to the point where ended up probably leaving 3 or 4 million people dead. He invaded the Dominican Republic to block what looked like a potential democratic revolution there, supported the Israeli occupation in its early stages. Again, we can go around the world. Take Carter.
You know, I'll get there, but Nixon's okay. Next.
Nixon, we don't even have to talk about. We can skip that one, okay?
But Ford, then Ford.
Well, Ford was only there for a short time, but long enough to endorse the Indonesian invasion of East Timor, which became about as close to genocide as anything in the modern period. They pretended to oppose it, but secretly supported, in fact, not so secretly. The U.S. Immediately after the invasion, the U.S. did join the rest of the world in formally condemning it at the Security Council. But Ambassador Moynihan was kind enough to explain to us, in his words, that his instructions were to render the United Nations utterly ineffective in any actions it might take to counter the Indonesian invasion. And he says proudly that he did this with considerable success. His next sentence says, in the next few months, it seems that about 60,000 people were killed. And then he goes off to the next topic. That's the first few months, went on to probably hundreds of thousands. Formally, the U.S. Announced a boycott of weapons, but secretly it increased the supply of weapons, including counterinsurgency equipment, so that the Indonesians could consummate the invasion. That's just a short period in office, but that's indictable. Seriously, in fact, that's a major war crime.
Carter
increased, as the Indonesian atrocities were increasing, they peaked in 1978, Carter's flow of weapons to Indonesia increased. When Congress imposed human rights restrictions, by then there was a human rights movement in Congress, to block the flow of advanced weaponry to Indonesia, Carter arranged through Mondale, Vice President, to get Israel to send U.S. Skyhawks to Indonesia to enable Indonesia to complete what turned out to be near genocide, killing maybe a quarter of the population or something. In the Middle East, Carter just won the Nobel Prize. His great achievement was the Camp David agreements. The Camp David agreements are presented as a diplomatic triumph for the United States. In fact, they were a diplomatic catastrophe. At Camp David, the United States and Israel accepted, finally, Egypt's 1971 offer, which they had then, U.S. had rejected at the time, except that now it was worse from the U.S.-Israeli point of view because it included the Palestinians. In order to accept, get Israel to accept Egypt's 1971 offer, after a major war and atrocities and so on, Carter raised aid, military and other aid to Israel, to more than 50% of total aid worldwide. Israel used it at once in exactly the way they said they were going to do, and as every sane person knew, as an opportunity to attack their northern neighbor, first in 1978, then in 1982, and to increase integration of the occupied territories. And that's for starters. We can continue.
Reagan?
I don't think we have to talk about that one either. I mean, Reagan is the first president to have been condemned by the International Court of Justice for what they called the unlawful use of force, meaning international terrorism, in the war against Nicaragua. Again, that's just for starters. They also, the Security Council, endorsed it in two resolutions, both of which were vetoed by the United States.
Bush won.
Well, we can begin with the invasion of Panama. The invasion of Panama, which, according to the Panamanians, killed about 3,000 people, since it's never investigated. We don't know if that's true or not. This was done in order to kidnap a disobedient thug who had been supported by the United States right through his worst atrocities.
Noriega.
He was brought to Florida and tried for crimes that he committed mostly on the CIA payroll. Okay, that's aggression. We could go into the details of the war in Iraq, there were plainly opportunities for, they might not have worked, we don't know, but there were opportunities for diplomatic settlement, which the Bush administration refused to consider, and incidentally the press would not report, with a single exception, and Long Island Newsday, which did report the whole story throughout accurately, and is the only newspaper in the country to have done so. The Bush administration then did attack, and the attack was carried out in a manner which is criminal under the laws of war. They attacked infrastructure. I mean, if you attack New York City and you destroy the electrical system, the power system, the sewage systems, and so on, that amounts to biological warfare, and that's the nature of the attack. Then came a sanctions regime, which it's mostly Clinton, but began with Bush, which is, by conservative estimates, killed hundreds of thousands of people while strengthening Saddam Hussein. That takes us off to Clinton, which, that's the beginning, but that's by no means the end. That one case suffices.
All right.
But there are plenty of others.
Bush, too?
Let's go on with Clinton.
Okay.
And one of Clinton's minor escapades, very minor, was sending a couple of cruise missiles to the Sudan to destroy what they knew to be a pharmaceutical plant. There was no intelligence failure. According to the only estimates we have from the German ambassador and the regional director of Near East Foundation, who does field work in Sudan, both of them estimate several tens of thousands of deaths from one cruise missile attack. It's pretty serious. If somebody did that to us, we'd regard it as bad news. And again, we can continue. In the Middle East, for example, Clinton began by declaring past UN resolutions, in the words of his administration, obsolete and anachronistic. Okay, so we're finished with that. No more international law. Then comes a period called a peace process, except that during the peace process, Israeli settlement, which means settlement paid for by the U.S. taxpayer and supported by U.S. military aid and diplomacy, continually increased. The most extreme year was Clinton's last year, the highest level of settlement, the highest since 1992. Meanwhile, the territories were cantonized, broken up into small regions with infrastructure projects and new settlement. I don't know what you call that, but it's under military occupation. And if anyone else was doing it, we'd call it a war crime. And again, we can continue. Bush, too, I don't think we have to discuss.
So what was the purpose? The purpose is to show you that historically, we have trusted our leaders, not realizing that these leaders have people they consult with who guide them in their domestic and foreign policies. And this is never brought down to a level of, do we need this? Is this beneficial to the planet, to our working with other countries? And it's always against us. But behind this are different parties, the lobbyists, the huge army of lobbyists that descend upon every member of Congress from their first day in office, plying them with gifts and campaign contributions. But in turn, it's a quid pro quo. What do I get for the money I'm giving you? And this is why we're in the mess we are today. And right now we can fairly accurately say of all of our major issues, inflation, loss of jobs in the United States, manufacturing being exported, the great disparity between the have and have-nots, the balkanization of the American citizen to fight each other instead of looking at the common challenge that needs to be changed, this is where we're at. And this is unfortunate. I'll have part two tomorrow, and we'll have more on these issues. We're going to have some very interesting people coming up this week that I'll be sharing a forum with. In fact, tomorrow I'll be offering a forum for Peter Zinhan from the modern wisdom point of view. The old world order is about to collapse, and he will discuss that, and then I will offer my input as to what I feel is wrong with his analysis. That's tomorrow. In the interim, have a nice day.